A few short years ago, Deborah Tannen wrote a book entitled You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. Many readers, both women and men, felt she had identified something crucial in the differences between men and women in how they use words, why they so often fail to understand each other, and what might be done about that. But a funny thing happened on the talk show circuit. Perhaps because she was trying to say something important about women, among other things, Deborah Tannen was suddenly thrust into the role of opposing masculine culture, whatever that is, and placed on the public stage to duke it out with opposing viewpoints. Isn't it odd how the search for truth can so easily degrade into a boxing match? Anyway, these and other observations eventually led Dr. Tannen, a linguist by training, to an examination of the antagonistic nature of public dialogue in the late 20th century. By now, you have probably seen her latest book on that topic, entitled The Argument Culture, Stopping America's War of Words. It was published last year in hardcover, and a paperback edition was recently published by Ballantine Books. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with Deborah Tannen about the argument culture. As we do, you are invited into our conversation. Questions and comments are welcome. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 or anywhere you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, wherever our signal travels, 800-222-9455. Again, within the 217 area code 333-WILL and toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Deborah Tannen is a frequent guest on many national television and radio programs, including Good Morning America, The Today Show, ABC World News Tonight, 2020, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, one of my favorite shows, and Oprah. And she's been featured in and has written for such magazines and newspapers as Newsweek, Time, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. An internationally recognized scholar, she's university professor and professor of linguistics at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and The Argument Culture is her 16th book. Let's say good morning to our guest. It wasn't just your own experience that led you to write this book, but you do write about a number of things that happened to you that have highlighted the issue for you.
Yes, why don't I just give one anecdote that captures what I mean by the argument culture. And I don't want to imply this was a typical experience, but it was not completely unheard of either. I was invited on a local television talk show and told that there was going to be a man there to represent the other side. Since my book is, you just don't understand, it's about women's and men's styles. I didn't really know what that meant, but I said that was fine. Well, I got to the studio, and I encountered a man who was wearing a shirt and tie and a floor-length skirt, and he had waist-length red hair. And I want to say I have nothing against cross-dressers, but I think he was doing this just to be provocative. He said to me, before we went on the air, I read You Just Don't Understand, I like it very much, but when I get out there, I'm going to attack you. Don't take it personally. That's why they invite me on, so that's what I'm going to do. And sure enough, the show started. I made a few comments, very few. He began attacking me, but then he quickly moved into an obviously canned and pre-planned diatribe against women. And what was really striking and what is the main point for me now is the effect that it had on the studio audience. The format of the show, it was an Oprah-style format. Many shows I was on had that format. So there was a studio audience, two guests, this gentleman and myself. And then there were women who had just come on, you know, the average women who had been invited to come on and talk about problems they had communicating with their husbands. Well, what happened was that when they began talking about their experiences, the audience turned vicious and began attacking them and accusing them of all the evil motives that this man had just described, and said things like, you know, you don't deserve your husband, he should leave you and find a woman who appreciates him. And I had never seen this happen before because, you know, this is what Oprah was so brilliant at, that format creates connections between the guests coming on, talking about their personal experience, the studio audience, the experts, Oprah, you know, the audience at home. And this was just the opposite. It broke down the sense of connection between the audience and those women that were invited on, and made them attack them instead and feel superior to them. And this is what the argument culture does. It breaks down the connections between people.
That's so interesting.
Orville Schell has written about this, about the press. He's a journalist at the University of California, Berkeley, a very experienced one, and he's written that in his day, you always wrote from a sense of connection to your subject. Now, it didn't. You might be very critical, but what he sees now, he said, is not just critical. It's savage, and it's contemptuous. And he said this is destructive to everybody's spirit, and it makes everybody feel under siege and insecure, including the journalists themselves. And we see this boomerang effect that because of the constant attacks on public figures, the average person now has contempt for public figures, but they also have contempt for the press. And that's very dangerous in a democracy.
Well, it seems to not only create that disconnection between people, but also gets in the way of solving problems. I'm reminded of there was an interview that we did with Benjamin Barber, who teaches political science, actually sociology. And he wrote in a book about civil society recently, about his own experience doing a radio, actually it was a television talk show, it was a public television station, and it was a taping, and he was placed in opposition to a conservative spokesperson, and he didn't say who it was, but they had a very amiable conversation. They're taping this program, and they're actually agreeing on a lot of things and finding a lot of common ground, and the host suddenly stops the interview and says, could you two argue a little bit more? You know, could you disagree a little bit more and make it more interesting?
So many people have told me of experiences like that. And when I say the argument culture, that's exactly what I mean. I'm talking about ritualized, phony, trumped-up fights for the purpose of display. I'm not opposing the real differences. One of the great things about a democratic country like ours is that we can air our differences and arguments in public, and it's essential that we be able to make arguments and argue with each other. But what we've done now is try to squeeze everything into this Procrustean bed of two sides polarized in perennial battle with each other. And yes, it gets in the way of solving the problems because we allow the polarized extremes to define the problem. An example would be the drug war. Mm-hmm. And all politicians are forced into one extreme or the other. Either you're for legalization or you're for throwing everybody in jail. And there's really no room for the complexity or the middle ground. Yet most people fall somewhere in the middle. So when they see that their views are never represented on the air, that contributes to their cynicism and alienation. And we end up thinking, well, you know, you can't solve this problem because the two sides are so polarized. But we've allowed those polarized extremes to define the debate because they're the best ones when you're looking for a fight.
You write about war metaphors and the notion that everything has to be a battle or a contest, a fight to the finish. There are always winners and losers, and this applies in areas that don't even relate necessarily to, you know, that clear-cut, a kind of, you know, dividing line between winners and losers. You say something very interesting about this, that, you know, we use language, but what ends up happening is language ends up using us.
Yes, and that's a phrase that I love very much. We, especially Americans, have a tendency to think of language as being just a receptacle. You know, you take your ideas, you pack them up in language, send them to someone else unpacks them and gets the ideas out. So we think the ideas, our thought processes, have independent reality apart from language. But they don't. You really can't pick apart language and thinking. When we talk about things in war metaphors, we start thinking about them in that way, and that actually influences how we act on them. It's very common in academia to talk in these kinds of terms. So in a class, for example, you know, you'll hear people say, I'd like to leap into the fray. You know, he shot down my ideas. Let me take a shot at that. And this actually does encourage us a way of thinking that is really quite pervasive in academia, but you see it in journalism as well, that to show you're really thinking, you have to criticize. If you just say someone's work is good and here's something interesting about it, within academia, that's uninteresting. In journalism, that's a puff piece. You're rolling over.
Right.
And so people, the journalists, feel that they're not really, you know, not doing a good job if they're not attacking somebody. The, you know, if you hear a fight outside your window, you run to see what's happening. But if there's a fight outside your window every night, you just shut that window and try to block it out. And this is what we're seeing with all these issues turning into fights. Then when the real fight comes along, nobody's listening.
Interesting. Well, where does this come from? We talked about the media, but it's not solely a media phenomenon. I think maybe that's where we see most of it, or maybe that's where it is certainly highlighted, because that seems to be what the producers feel it takes to get ratings.
Yes, we see it. Perhaps, you know, the press is a good place to start, because we all deal with it every day. We think of it especially with television, and television being a visual medium and a spectacle is especially given to that. Print journalism is not innocent either, though. It takes a slightly different form. In print journalism, you see the desire for balance. But what that often means is that the person presenting the story doesn't feel they really need to look below the surface and give hearers, if it's radio, or readers, if it's print, and give them the information or the facts, but rather you quote somebody on one side, you quote somebody on the other side. Well, that's it. You've provided balance. Your job is done. And that sometimes means that they scour the fringes of lunacy to find someone to represent the other side, and it's presented as a balanced view rather than, okay, 90% of the experts are on this side and here's 10% on the other side. But absolutely, the press is one part of it, but by no means the cause or the only part. We see really intertwined, inextricably intertwined, politics, people in public life, the press, and the law. And you can see it in the current scandal, of course, in a very clear way. But politicians, of course, have to oppose each other in a campaign. But in the past, and that's a military metaphor right there,
sure,
the campaign. After the campaign, then they would go about the business of running the government, and then they would start campaigning again when the next election rolled around. Well, now we have the permanent campaign, where campaign tactics are used throughout the term, so that often, and by the way, Newt Gingrich has said on several occasions publicly to reporters that even before Bill Clinton was elected president, he, Newt Gingrich, had determined that he could not let the president succeed in health care reform, because if he did, he would then be unbeatable in the next election. So it becomes a higher priority to keep your opponents from getting elected than it is to actually do the work of running the country. And the rise of negative advertising and opposition research, which is certainly in some sense fueled by the technology itself. You can now dig up the records on your opponent, and so we're finding people using things like accusing an opponent of not paying back his student loans, or bringing up details from a divorce case.
I was just going to sort of try to get at some of the roots of this. We've always had intense competition in various, you know, theaters of life, in particular politics. You know, the press has never been completely respectful of public figures. You know, there's always been that sort of muckraking mentality in certainly in American press. But what we're talking about is a different order, is it not, from in the past?
Yes, absolutely. Has a great tradition and a healthy tradition. The press must have an adversarial relationship with the government. Our legal system is an adversarial system. Two lawyers on each side, they slug it out. One side wins. And we could point to many triumphs of our legal system in righting wrongs. But the claim that I'm making in this book is twofold. One, the level of opposition has gone up. The use of ritualized opposition is has become more pervasive and more extreme in the forms that it takes. And also that we've developed an ethic of aggression by which we value aggressive tactics and no longer value compromise or conciliation. And that means that people are less likely to behave in a way that's compromising. Henry Clay was called the great compromiser. We couldn't imagine somebody called a great compromiser because we don't think of it as a great thing to do. We think it's weak and wishy-washy. You know, I see this even in private life, and I'll give an example. I was on a talk show, again, talking about You Just Don't Understand. A woman called in, and she said, "What's wrong with me?" I was in a room where there was a no-smoking sign, and a man was smoking. And I said to him, "Oh, excuse me, sir, I'm terribly sorry, but I have asthma. It makes it hard for me to breathe when you're smoking. Would you mind very much putting that out?" And he was very chivalrous, very polite. He put a cigarette out, and I said, "Oh, thank you, thank you." And then she said, "Well, what's wrong with me?" And I said, "Well, it sounds to me like you handled it very well. You accomplished what you wanted. You got him to put a cigarette out." She said, "Yeah, but why did I say it in that way? I should have said, 'There's a no smoking sign there. You should put that out.'" But had she done that, there's a pretty good chance he would not have wanted to accommodate her. He might well have said, "Well, who made you the enforcer? Mind your own business."
But so, the fact that she thought there was something wrong with being nice.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. It's this ethic of aggression that now we think we ought to be aggressive toward each other. And if we aren't, there's something wrong with us. We're lacking in self-esteem or something. But this is how communication works. We have ritualized, conventionalized, you might say, ways of helping other people save face when they give us what we want. And that is it's a powerful strategy. It's not a weak strategy. But because of this ethic of aggression, she felt guilty.
Something that I think I have observed with regard, especially the past year, in the media and politics, and of course, I'm sure everyone knows what I'm talking about, the situation with the impeachment and so forth. It almost seems to me like what has happened is a gigantic feedback loop between the partisanship in Washington, in Congress in particular, and the media playing off that, feeding back into that whole partisan rhetoric in Washington, which simply ups the ante. And meanwhile, everyone else around the country is just shrugging their shoulders going, "How do we stop this?"
Yes. You know, obviously I wrote the book before this latest scandal broke, but it was really as if it stepped off the pages of the book in a more extreme form than even I had foreseen. You see, absolutely, the press and the politicians playing into each other, but also the legal system. All three systems intertwined. So just real briefly, the whole scandal, you can trace it back to an article written in the American Spectator. This is one thread, anyway. Mm-hmm. An article written in the American Spectator by David Brock. And David Brock is the one person who has apologized, because he wrote an article saying how sorry he was that he put the name Paula in his article. But he says there that his one goal, he was hired by the American Spectator to dig up dirt on the president. That was his goal. He went to Arkansas, found as many rumors as he could, put them in. And he mentioned the woman named Paula. Well, people in Arkansas easily identified her as Paula Jones, so she felt, and possibly her husband, apparently some people think, was egging her on in this, that she had to clear her name. Well, once it was known that here was this woman who was suing the president, political opponents of his saw this as an opportunity and funded her suit. So there you have the political opponents using the legal system as a way to destroy their opponent. And, of course, the press played this up as they had played up Whitewater. It's almost as if the press is addicted to scandal. Mm-hmm. And don't want to. They feel deprived when there isn't one. But this is a process that has been going on for a long time. Politicians often feel that they simply cannot get on the evening news unless they attack somebody. So if they hold a news conference and outline their proposal, it's not very exciting. It's not going to make good TV coverage. It's not going to be reported. But if they get up there and insult their opponent, this is a pretty juicy thing, and they're much more likely to get on the evening news. So it is definitely a feedback loop between these, but I would say the three institutions.
We have a couple of calls to talk with, and let's include them in our conversation. We have first a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. Actually, I think there's an interesting corollary between what you're describing, this sort of argument culture, and a devastating homogeneity or sameness in our culture. You know, you listen to the radio, watch the news, read the papers of record, and you pretty much get kind of a singular viewpoint of the world. You turn on the television and you flip through 61 channels and you get, you know, not very much variety. You listen to classical music stations and you pretty much will hear music from the late 18th century to the very early 20th century. And you drive through most towns in America and they pretty much look the same. And I think that strikes me as perhaps not merely a corollary to what you're describing, but perhaps there may be a relation, and I'm wondering if you have any comment on that.
Yes, you know, I'm fascinated by that. I never have thought of it that way, but I think you are putting your finger on something. We don't have real left-wing views represented in our media. Noam Chomsky might be an example of a real left-winger. He never gets on television. What we get is almost canned, almost like the man who got on with this canned diatribe against women. We get a canned Republican, you know, Republican Democrat, pro, con, for, against. And there's something about the number two that sets that up. If you had three, four, five guests, you would start getting varied views.
Yes.
And I make that contrast with other cultures in the same way that it goes way back in our culture. You can trace it back to Aristotle, to the Greeks, where we believe that opposition is the path to truth, and we break everything into dualisms, two sides, for, against, pro, con. Well, that is inextricably intertwined with our focus on conflict, because two sides are very prone to start fighting with each other. Well, Japanese culture places the emphasis on harmony. Not that they don't have conflict, but that they focus on harmony as a way to manage conflict. And Japanese talk shows never have two guests. They have three or more, or they have one. And they don't go in for these dualisms the same way that we do. So, you know, we think of male-female, the war between the sexes. If you think of the yin-yang symbol in Chinese culture, for example, if you picture it, you know, each one is folding into the other and has a small circle of the other within it. It's not split down the middle in this dualistic way that we tend to. So I think your caller is absolutely right that with all the apparent fights, we really have a very narrow band of information and views being put forth.
That's right. And, of course, it's like a Punch and Judy show. You know, you have two opponents. And, of course, the framework of their opposition is extremely narrow, which, in my mind, is what we see in, you know, these so-called oppositions. And then the other one comment I want to make about Plato is that Plato stressed dialectics, not opposition. And dialectics is quite different than opposition. And I think what we see, what you're describing, of course, is opposition. And what would be an interesting thing to see would be dialectics.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's usually traced to Aristotle, the belief that conflict and opposition are the path to truth. But and this may be a little bit what you're referring to. People often say, well, that's the Socratic method. But what we use as the Socratic methods, some philosophers that I quote in the argument culture point out, was not really the Socratic method, because the goal of that was to persuade. But nobody is persuaded by the kinds of arguments that we have, where it's just a matter of every idea is immediately opposed. So it's almost like you're playing ping pong, and wherever the ball goes, that's where you reach out and bang it back. Nobody is persuaded, because it really does not open minds. We think of two sides to every issue as the essence of open-mindedness and expansive thinking. But in fact, it's reductive, because most issues are a crystal of many sides.
the beauty of a sporting event is that the nature of their activity is rather trivial, so we can focus on the relationship of their opposition. And I guess we could say that about most debate and also the presentation of culture by, you know, art and music and all these other kinds of things. Well, thank you.
What you're saying is very much in line with what I talk about in the book. Sports would be a perfect example of what I'm calling ritualized opposition. It's not a real fight, but you set it up, and it has many of the trappings of a fight. Two sides, they oppose each other, one side wins, and they can talk about destroying the enemy. But that's a form of entertainment that people really watch for entertainment. But if we turn our news and information shows into something like a sporting event, and we cover politics as if it were just a horse race, a sporting event, and instead of asking what are the two candidates' policies, we ask who's ahead today, who's winning, who's losing. That then takes the place of getting information, and that's where it starts actually getting in our way.
We're a little past our midpoint this morning with linguist Deborah Tannen, and we're talking about her book, The Argument Culture, Stopping America's War of Words. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll get right to, and I'll mention the phone numbers if you'd like to join us. We have a couple lines open. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. We've got someone on a payphone on line number two. Let's talk with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. Am I on now?
Yes.
Excellent. I just wanted to compliment Dr. Tannen very much on the thesis of her concepts there, because it's something that I think I've felt and identified with in a different era, because I live overseas a good deal of my life and then back here in this country. And what I see, I think, is the same thing. I've only used slightly different terminology, which is an addiction to intensity. And in this country, it seems to me that the people here are addicted to this combative lifestyle in order to give themselves a simulation of reality or of being, almost a virtual existence, because they are in an intense, geared-up, adrenaline state, as opposed to being able to sit back and look at a pond or go fishing or be meditative. And I find it very difficult to be back in this country because everybody is so stimulated and upset and angry and addicted to intensity all the time.
What countries did you live in?
Well, I've lived a good deal in the Mideast, in Europe, and some in the former Soviet countries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the compliment and also for the points that you make. I think you're quite right that it can become addictive. And I think there's a belief out there that people like to watch a good fight. In fact, many people do, but many people don't.
Right.
People do find that it makes their blood pressure go up. It makes their stress, they're already overstressed, and it makes their stress level go up. But I think there's a belief that it is in making the ratings go up, but what you're actually getting is a small group of listeners who are addicted to those shows, and then a very large group that is completely tuning them out.
Does that get your points, caller?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go on next to a listener in Champaign on line number three. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
I'm having a hard time figuring out which way to go with this, because you get a lot of intensity when things are viewed as important. I mean, that's kind of like the key element of high emotion is that somebody thinks something's important. You don't like... you don't like argumentation, but I would say that a lot of our institutions, one of the greatest problems is that they, because of avoiding any kind of image of being unsure about what's going on, or their unwillingness to confront real, very big issues that are just unresolved, you know, they go for behavior that merely preserves the status quo, merely preserves our unresolving issues. And it sounded like you wanted to talk there.
Well, I appreciate that comment because it allows me to emphasize what is maybe one of the main points here, that the opposite of the argument culture, as I'm using the term, is not let's stop arguing and be nice to each other. It's let's stop having the phony arguments and have the real ones. And I quote a Yugoslavian poet, Charles Simic, who says it's absolutely necessary to speak out, lash out, vituperate in the strongest possible terms when you see an injustice or something you feel very passionate about. So I agree completely. We need to be able to have the real arguments, but I do make a distinction between having an argument and making an argument. We need to make arguments to persuade, to lead to a point of view. But you know the feeling when you're having an argument with someone you're close to in your private life, you're not listening to what they're saying. You're not trying to understand their point of view. You just want to win the argument. So if they say something that you know has some truth to it, you know that feeling. You ignore that. You let that go by. You wait until they say something really outrageous, and that's what you leap on. You know, how can you say this horrible thing? Well, you know, maybe you can't avoid that in our personal lives, but it is not constructive to be structuring our public discourse in that way. And that, it's like it creates so much noise in the channel that we really can't get out there to confront and argue about the real issues confronting us.
Well, but... I mean, we've kind of elevated certain groups to be leaders in being able to sort out, to be able to define our problems, sort out what kind of language this society has, so sort out what kind of language we'd use, and they're just failing to, and I believe it's because they have an agenda. And that agenda very often is just to preserve the status quo. And I just wanted to mention that, and I'll hang up because this is kind of this is a very interesting conversation. I'd like to hear some other people. But I was looking through my notes here, and there's a book called Closed Chambers, and it had to do with the Supreme Court you know, the way they resolve issues, and I thought I'd read a sentence here out of it. The image of the court that I carry with me is of an institution broken into unyielding factions that have largely given up on a meaningful exchange of their respective views, or, for that matter, a meaningful explication or defense of their own views. It is of justices who, in many important cases, resort to transparently deceitful and hypocritical arguments and factual distortions as they discard judicial philosophy and consistent interpretation in favor of bottom-line results. So my point is that even amongst such illustrious members of society as the Supreme Court, it's a very difficult thing that you're hoping for there. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
That's quite an interesting perspective that I actually hadn't encountered before, that there may be a parallel to this even in the Supreme Court. I certainly talk about it in politics, press, the law, and,
right.
and education, our educational system as well. Maybe that's the root of it.
Well, I certainly want to talk about that before we run out of time. We got a couple of callers waiting. I do want to, though, follow up and maybe amplify the point a little bit in the sense of the political climate. You know, we saw it clearly in the healthcare debate, which really wasn't a debate on healthcare policy so much as it was, you know, what's wrong with this or that, you know, idea. I mean, what we didn't really get to the actual ideas and how they would work in the real world. It was more a matter of throwing hand grenades, I suppose.
Well, several excellent books have been written about that, and I quote some of them, so a brief kind of summary from the books that I read about this, the healthcare reform was really brought down not by an actual argument of the issues, but by a whole series of ritualized attack. So the press really did not do its job of communicating to the average person what was at stake, because it was too busy reporting which side is winning, which side is losing. This is a blow to the Clinton administration. This is a triumph for the opposition. And they didn't simply tell people what the program was and what the pros and cons were. Also, and this is another point made by others who have written about this, that we used to have a balance of power between political parties and interest groups. Political parties have lost much of their power because they no longer pick candidates. It's done by popular election. So they can't guarantee a candidate, vote with us, and we're going to put you in office next time. So what's left is the interest groups, and interest groups tend to be against things. They want to stop anything that's going to change the status quo. It gets back to what your caller was just saying, especially something that's going to, they fear, take away some perk that they now have. And as we know, the insurance companies and other interest groups played a very large part in bringing that down.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone on the campus here at the University of Illinois on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I had a question. In my first degree, I was a comm major, and part of my senior thesis focused on the idea that combative speech and extremely combative sports, too, I was kind of linking the two, are a substitute for battle. In other words, we're kind of bored, and we need some combat in our lives, and this is the way we substitute for it, not having it actively, and I was wondering what you thought of that.
Again, yeah, very good point, and I do, I really do discuss that in quite a bit of depth in the book, that, yeah, every culture has ritualized ways of working out opposition and fighting, and sports is a perfect example of the constructive way you can do that, but I think in our culture, this is the point that I'm making, that in our culture in the last, say, 10, maybe 20 years, we have turned everything into a ritualized fight, mm-hmm. and we don't have the rules in place to make sure that it remains constructive. Mm-hmm. But the tendency, of course, is there in all cultures, and I do discuss quite a bit some of the constructive ways that ritualized opposition is used in other cultures.
Could you give an example of that?
I talk about how in China there's great negative reaction to opposition and confrontation and conflict. But when it builds up, and this is in rural China, and I quote an anthropologist there, there's an actual ritualized way mm-hmm. that someone, can, especially it's used by women, can oppose, say, her husband, who she feels is behaving badly, and it's a ritual called reviling the street. But it's very circumscribed because it's a certain way she does it, a certain place she does it. She'll be on her porch. She will never step off the porch. She will not do it when she's alone. She will do it when a certain number of people from town are there to hear her. And this makes public her complaint against her husband, and then people within that culture, within the village, will bring to bear pressure on him to behave more appropriately. Hmm. So it's a very structured way of using opposition in a culture that normally doesn't accept it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left with Deborah Tannen talking about her book, The Argument Culture. And we've got a couple callers waiting, and we'll try to get both of them in. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, thanks. Again, a really interesting conversation, and I just wanted to sort of chime in with some of the experiences that I've had here in the university with, I think, the phenomenon that you're talking about. And for me, it's sort of come up in what I think maybe generally could be called postmodern ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding this in a number of different kinds of courses that I take, very interdisciplinary kind of thing, that there is this sort of notion that people just can't understand that there are certain differences that really can't be crossed. From what I've been able to determine so far, that this is really based for some sort of philosophers on linguistics, that there's something sort of in the very nature of language that contributes to this. I'm thinking of Derrida, this whole idea of difference in meaning, like Wittgenstein, who talk about different language games. And I guess I was wondering what your reaction might be to kind of this postmodern linguistic take and this idea that in some sense really difference is inevitable. And I guess the other thing that I've noticed that's particularly troublesome to me is that a lot of times when you're trying to make an argument and come to agreement, or at least suggest the possibility of agreement, people will sometimes, though not always, suggest that you're totalizing or that you're trying to impose some kind of universal standard on people who think differently and that it's not fair. And to me, that's even worse than, you know, promoting argument culture. It's really blocking discussion completely. There's just a complete breakdown. And I didn't know, since it sounds like your background is in linguistics, whether you had any particular thoughts about that kind of postmodern take on linguistics and difference and so forth. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, gee, I can think of different ways of responding to what you just said. There are some aspects of postmodern theory that really would not fall into the polarization or opposition framework, I don't think, but would be more kind of relativistic, that you can't really place any meaning on anything because it's all constructed. But there is this other branch of postmodern theory that is very critical of what they call reductionist, of talking about people in another culture as being a certain way, and this has been used also to criticize some writers in gender as well, you know, that you can't essentialize women and men. But the most interesting take on that, in my mind, was a woman who had, her name is Anne Carolyn Klein, and she had been in studying Buddhism in India, but I think it was Tibetan Buddhism. And she wrote a book called Meeting the Great Bliss Queen, and it's a wonderful book. And one thing she mentions there is that she came back to the American Academy because of her work in religion, theology, and women in religion, and found that the feminist theory within the United States was being separated into two camps. You know, the social constructivist camp, that's one group, and then the difference camp, another group, and they were hating each other and stigmatizing each other. And she said, but she saw this as very Western, that in itself that was reductionist. It was reducing people with very complicated ideas and theories and approaches and sticking them to only one camp or the other. And then again, once you have two camps, it's quite natural that they're going to start fighting each other. And she said, obviously we all feel that in some ways gender is constructed, and in some ways women and men are different. If you really didn't think that, you couldn't even talk about women as a group if there wasn't a clear difference. So anyway, I found that a very nice antidote to that tendency to polarize that we see in the American Academy.
Well, very good. We've got just about 5 minutes left and a couple calls waiting. We'll go next to a listener on a car phone on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask Ms. Tannen if she had run across a book that I saw in bookstores a while ago. It was written by a lawyer named Jerry something or other. He's a Colorado lawyer, wears a suede fringe jacket a lot on television.
Oh, yeah. Gary Spence?
Pardon?
Gary Spence, I believe.
Okay, yeah, that's probably it. At any rate, I remember the title of the book, and it was something like How to Win an Argument Every Single Time. And I remember having been so deeply offended that this fellow could be so arrogant, and I remember having thought, what a miserable human being he must be to live with and to work with and so forth. And he obviously does fancy himself some kind of independent cowboy spirits and everything. But I remember having thought that, first of all, of course, the goal is completely wrong, you know, to just essentially win at all costs and shove your point of view down the other person's throat. And the other thing I kept thinking is, you know, I realize, and everybody should realize and keep in mind, that sometimes I'm wrong. Sometimes, you know, I need to have somebody remind me of the fact that I don't have all the answers, and that, you know, we all, it's like the whole business of the journey versus the goal. I mean, for me, a large part of the quality of life is the journey itself and not necessarily the goal. And I guess in that same line of thinking, the goal is communication, not necessarily winning. I mean, sometimes it's nice to you know, to hash things out and find, yeah, I was right about this. I had a gut instinct and blah, 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 and I was right. But the goal is really communication, and I think that certainly is the first thing lost in this kind of thing. And I was just wondering if you had seen this fellow or if you'd seen the book and if it struck you the same way it did me.
I don't know the book and I don't know the person, but I certainly know the attitude. And I think you're right that it's reflective of the kind of thing we're talking about, that you turn everything into a fight, and so the opposite, the goal is to win. Just as when you're having a debate as opposed to a conversation or a discussion. In a debate, the goal is to win. If the other person makes a point that you think is valid, you ignore that, or you you only want to pick out the arguments that are going to support your side so you can win the debate. So I think that's certainly related to what we're talking about.
And I think it's ultimately very destructive, and I think you're seeing it sort of on a larger palette, let's say, or a larger screen than I am, because you have traveled around the country more and discussed this issue.
I do try to show these patterns in as many different areas as I can, and I have a long chapter on the law
yes.
and how, and really try to question and look into our adversarial legal system. What are some of its strengths, but also what are some of its weaknesses? Carrie Mankel-Meadow, for example, a law professor at Georgetown, points out, in most cases, there's some right on both sides. So if you have a system that awards everything to one side, from one point of view, you can't have a just result.
I'm sorry to say we have just a couple of minutes left, and we got another caller we won't be able to include because we simply don't have time. Sorry about that. And there's much we're not going to be able to get to that is in the book. Just it's sort of to finish up, I wonder what your thoughts are about the issue of dualism as a worldview and this American notion we seem to have. I think it seems like an American notion of the self versus society. You know, you know, the individual versus the world.
Yes. One of the many levels on which we approach things in a more adversarial spirit than perhaps some Asian cultures. If you listen to talk shows, you hear them constantly talking about the self in opposition to society. You have to identify your real self and not what society is trying to force on you. You have to resist society's demands of you. And there are many cultures of the world, maybe really most cultures of the world, where the self is thought of as in the network of society. And people don't even have a concept of themselves except as related to their families and their community. Level where we approach everything in this adversarial spirit.
Yeah. Well, we just finished a conversation with a speech researcher, the hour before this, where the point was made that we, in many ways, we define ourselves by our relationships with other people and in conversation with others, and that we don't exist outside. I mean, we may physically exist, but in many ways, our own self-identity relates to everyone else's identities as well.
Yes, and that's certainly true, and you can even say that you can only experience something in opposition to something else. In other words, you don't know where your boundaries are until you knock up against something else. But I would still claim that the way we Americans approach it tends to atomize the individual somewhat more and place the individual in opposition to society and other people somewhat more than other cultures would. And not to say that that's bad. I mean, there's, we...